today is annual report. Not only yourself, but your entities as well after you. And it will continue that way up to next week. We have interacted with the department. There are certain things that we were not happy about, and we said when you are coming for your annual report, those areas that were not happy, where we asked you to come up with the details of when and how these things will take place. So I'm sure today that the presentation will not be general. It will be specific to certain issues of interest to us. And I hope that the DG has been briefed fully by the department. We also wish to welcome the new DG. He's coming for the first time to the committee, but of course, we have been interacted with him number of times. So, Mr. Manyi, you are welcomed by this committee as the DG of the Department of Labor. I'm also told that the presentation of the Department of Labor is going to be done by the DG. So, can we... You will start, but also you'll have to tell us who's around in the house.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. And good morning also to the Honorable members of the House, media, and everybody in the room. Honorable Chair, with me, I have the top team of the Department of Labor. All the DDGs are here. And all the commissioners are here. I'm sure most of them are known to the House. I've got the CFO. I've got everybody, Honorable Chair, that is the top team of the department. Okay. I note the opening comments of the Honorable Chair that there were specific issues that have been his expectation that they be responded to. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to do two things. First, I'm going to just make the assumption that the annual report is taken as read because it's a document that was made available some time ago. But what we thought we'd do as a department is just to just go through quickly through the salient features of the report, just so that I can refresh the honourable members' memories as to what the report contained. But I'm going to whiz through very quickly through that, as I said, because I'm taking it as read. And then what we've also prepared, the Honorable Chair, are certain interventions to correct a whole range of things that have been pointed out in the last discussions and by the AG as well. Yeah. Subject to time, Honorable Chair, we can also give you a detailed report of the actions and progress in terms of where we are on a point by point on the matters that the AG raised in his report. So we actually have a lot of information with us. It could just be a question of if there is enough time to deal with all of this. But without any further waste of time, then if it's okay, Honorable Chair, let me just take you through very quickly on the annual report. The structure of the report is as outlined over there, where we've got about five programs. There's a section that deals with administration, and then we deal with the technical areas of the department, starting with the service delivery, And then we talked to the Employment and Skill Development Services. We also talked to labor policy and labor market programs. And then the social infrastructure will be reported in this afternoon. So we won't say much about it this time around. We're just highlighting the Honorable Chair, the key results areas of government in general, just to make the point that we are aware of all of them, and we try by all means to ensure that whatever we do is informed by those priority areas of government, so that we are not misaligned. When we look at the administration, those are the key areas that we look at: communication, financial management, HR, and the IT. And again, we also have internal audit issues, we've got risk management issues, we've got security services. Those are the all the areas that cover the administration. In terms of what we've done in that section, on stakeholder relations, there's a full report on page 26 of the annual report, but just simply to say that the department has been working hard to make sure that the department is known nationally. We participate in a whole range of opportunities to showcase the services that the department is offering. We have a whole range of campaigns that we do, whether it's electronic or print media, just to make sure that we're top of mind. On the HR space, we have a plan that goes up to the end of this financial year, and that talks to a whole range of things, from training and development to performance management and to the three pillars of employee health and wellness. We've implemented all of those programs. We also have an employment equity program in the department, which we monitor regularly. On the financial side, Honorable Chair, we also have a full-blown financial report, but we're counting on that tomorrow. But if the House needs that report here today, we're also ready with that report. We'll be guided by the House. In terms of the regular audit matters that we have queries for Dole, for NSF, for Sheltered Employment, Indlela, CIF, and UIF, all of those areas. There were one or two things that the AG raised. Some are more serious than others. Also on the annual financial statements, the budgets have now been put together in terms of the required prescripts. When we look at the financial liaisons and issues of the public entities, what have we done? We've implemented enhancements on the financial statements. We've ensured that we facilitate submission analysis of quarterly financial reports. We identified performance gaps in generated reports for early warnings, analysis and capturing of budgeting information for the CETAs, follow-up and support of all critical and struggling public entities. We've been giving them guidance and feedback. We've also been doing a lot of capacity building, training and skills transfer to public entity personnel. Continuing the office of the CFO, on the administration and supply chain, what have we done there? We've managed the office accommodation and repair maintenance program on state-owned buildings through public works. I must say, though, that sometimes the program there is not as smooth running. From time to time, we battle to get things done. But again, there we have a full submission on our challenges around public works. But be that as it may, 9 contracts completed, 4 to go. Contract for 12 shared employment completed. Bid process for the issue building finalized, work has already started. Document security and archival storage facility improved, and so on and so on. And we also have the asset register for IT PPP, with Siemens that has been developed. On the IT achievements, policies developed to cover key areas in the IT environment. We now have information system security, network, and user security. IT disaster recovery plan has now been approved. Business applications deployed. Additional functionality and enhancement to current legacy systems at CF. Additions and enhancements to the EE system. That EE system will now ensure that when we get data, we get data broken up by province. At this stage, to date, we only have data at a national level. So that enhancement will ensure that if you want to know what the employment equity situation is by province, from now on we will have that information. These are rolled out to all labor centers, an enhancement made for stability and data integrity. I must point out, though, that that is not without its own challenges. That system is there, but it's not running smoothly, and it's a matter that we are raising continuously with Siemens. Yeah, so we're also continuously looking at ways of improving that employment service. There are quite a lot of world-class systems that do that service. So we're also looking at international benchmarks to ensure that our employment services are up to scratch. Financial management system for the UIF, CF, and NSF initiated, and also have service delivery improvement in remote areas where we try to have mobile centers, especially for the rural areas. But again, it was not without challenges, because one of the key issues is still the issue of satellite connectivity. So we're still having challenges there, but the intention of having mobile units, particularly to service in rural areas, is on course. In terms of internal audit, 57 audits for DOL, NSF and sheltered employment. Out of those, 51 are complete. 42 final audit reports issued. Audit committee of the department's functions optimally and meets regularly. Risk management unit introduced, and risk management plan developed, and it's to be managed by senior management. Security services. We have electronic systems implemented in high-risk KZN, several security appraisals and assessments implemented in key provincial offices and labor centers, tender processes to improve compensation fund security at advanced stage, but right now it's actually done. It was advanced stage as in then, but as we speak now, that has now been achieved. Contract security procured for various offices and labor centers. Cases of IT equipment losses reduced by 75%. Officials are paying back the department the rent value of equipment losses. And then when you go to service delivery, we're happy to say that the increases in percentage of those that work seekers place in the employment opportunities has gone up to focusing to achieve 70%, but I must say again that that will also have challenges as we move around because of the economic recession, but that was the target that we set. Assess and refer 10% of work seekers to identified critical and scarce skills development programs. Ensure training of 90,000 unemployed people. Again, I must say, program director, around that one as well. From time to time, we hit snags around the procurement policy issues, misalignment with, not misalignment, but to comply with the national treasury regulations around procurement of service providers. That has slowed down the progress in that what happens, for instance, you find that in terms of the requirements, we have to get three quotes for the same kind of service. Now, it's very easy to get that in Cape Town and Johannesburg, but if you have to get three quotes of service providers in Limpopo or somewhere in rural areas in the Eastern Cape, it's not always possible. But if we have to comply, we have to wait and try and do all kinds of things to be able to get the 3 codes. Now, in the process of doing that, you lose time. So those are some of the challenges. Reduce on the E&E, reduce workplace-related injuries, illness, and death by 2%. That's the target to ensure 75 compliance with labor legislation and so on. I just want to go to how far we've gone on those. Yeah. If you go to the actual performance, if you look at the output there, that's at the high level. We're looking at having a single integrated employment services system. And I won't read everything through there just in the interest of time, but I'm sure members can see the detail there in terms of how much that the system has been rolled out throughout all 125 labor centers. And then we also, I think it's all in there. Members can see as we go through. There's just too many numbers here. I just want to make sure that we can get through everything that we need to get through today. Now, if we look at this output program to increase the percentage of registered work seekers placed in registered employment opportunities to 70%, where are we on that? Registered work seekers increased by 252,000. Placement opportunities on database increased by 10,000. There were 7,500 job opportunities. Over 421 job seekers were registered on the database compared to 169 in the previous year. So a lot more people have been registered. Over 26,000 placement opportunities were registered in the database compared to 15,000 of the previous year, and so on and so on. So I think this just shows that the department has been very hard at work to meet its targets. 8,500 registered job seekers were assessed, and that of the 800 that were assessed, 86%, which is 7,300, were referred to identified critical and skills development programs. 89% of the 8,000 learners were assessed, and so on. So again, it just shows that again the department has been hard at work to meet the outputs. On this one here, provincial skills plans were reviewed to ensure alignment with the PGDS, IDP, LED. And 1,600 projects were identified and listed. The training programs in the expanded work programs and the nodes were finalized. Total number of 10,000 unemployed were trained in support of the EPWP. A total number of 3,000 unemployed were trained in support of ISRDP, and so on. 20 provincial staff members on the project are capacitated to enforce the employment equity, and 74 employers are subject to the EEA DG review. That is also going very well. 12,500 designated employers were identified to enforce procedural compliance, and 9,000 were inspected. There's a noticeable increase in the capacity to monitor and enforce the employment equity procedural compliance. I must say, the Honorable Chair, that we also are getting a lot of good cooperation from the unions, and also the normal employees are becoming vigilant. We're getting a lot of feedback and commentary from people on the ground in terms of whistleblowing as well, that sometimes companies are not doing what they purport to be doing, and we do a lot of follow-ups to cover that. The compliance levels increased by 5% from 78% by 5 percentage points to 83%. The volume of workplace inspected and the current complement of inspectorate remains a challenge. When we talk to the vacancies at some point, given the time, we'll talk to that. But the key issue here is that we're trying to make sure that all the vacancies for the inspectorate are filled, and up until we have that done, we'll continue to have some challenges in terms of covering all the companies that we need to cover. A total of 178,079% of the labor complaints received were investigated and finalized within 90 days against a target of 80%, so we're just one percentage point out. A total of 56% of the 5,000 occupational health and safety incidents reported were investigated and finalized. When we look at the targeted advocacy and police inspections to inspect at least 10,000 workplaces and to decrease workplace incidents in the higher risk industries by at least 2%, how did we do that? We have had the advocacy and police inspections program developed targeting high risk industries, and we overshot the target by 285, and it's broken down as indicated there. When you go to the ESDS, Employment Services and Skills Development, those are the targets that we're trying to get to. And when you look at the budget that drives these skills, a total of 7 billion was collected, and it was spread into 5.8 to the CETAs and 1.5 to NSF. And then if we look at how did that play itself out, number SDS year 4 target implementation at Indian, how did we do there? We targeted 1,200 small BE enterprises and cooperatives to receive skills development. But the actual performance there was more than 100%, more than 100% at 2,251. 10,000 people participate in trade tests at Indlela, and 8,000 were assessed. The target there was 40% pass rate, and we achieved 41%, and 18,000 apprentices needed to have been registered for training, and we managed 17,000, a little bit out. And again, as you can see, there are the various status against targets, but in many cases, the department has overshot the targets. In the case of the undergraduates and postgraduates, where the actual performance is less than the target, it's really a subject of the people that we depend on, like the NRF, the NISFAS, in terms of the series that they award. From our side, our responsibility is to provide the money. So we've always had the money, but the institutions that need to claim this money have not been able to claim enough of what we had provided for them. So going forward, we've actually signed on an additional institution, careers something, to ensure that we can use up all that that money. Okay, again, 90,000 unemployed people trained, that was a target, and we've not done very well there. Only 15,000 were trained, and there are three key issues that affected that. One of them is the issue of recession, and again, this one of procurement. There's a third issue again, which escapes my mind for now. On the next point, 63,000 trained unemployed people placed in employment, only 30,000. Again, there it's a function of the recession. Companies are laying people off and all that. 400,000 community-based cooperatives received skill support, and 357 were trained. 5,000 SMEs and NGOs, co-ops and small BE enterprises skill support, and we overshot there. So clearly you can see that where we can, where we've got control, we've been able to meet the targets. Areas that we sometimes don't meet the targets is where we sometimes depend, our success depends on the performance by others. So that has been one of the reasons for not meeting some of the targets. Okay, in ABET, target is 44,000, we've got 40,000. And so on. As I'm sure members can see the numbers right there. And I'm going to skip through quickly just to preserve time. Sector development facilitators and specialists trained. We were meant to have trained 15,000. We trained 18,000. Again, whatever is in our control, we seem to achieve and overachieve our targets. And so on. Yeah, the numbers there. I'm just going to flip through in the interest of time. Annual increase of people who benefited from workplace skills development support, training for employment and re-employment. 2,000 more new workers have come on stream, and so on. Okay, and then in terms of accrediting institutions, 138 institutions accredited, and the target was 92 to improve the quality of service delivery by skills development. The refined quality council for trades and occupations, QCTO policy established 1.3 to improve stakeholder capacity and commitment to the national skills development strategy. Seven constituency organizations took up the funding, and 3,000 members benefited. Okay. Workplace skills development, total workers trained increased to 6,000 compared to 3,000 of the previous year, which is a major improvement. Okay. Towards conclusion, we talk about the labor market policy and management issues. We just list there that 74 companies, these are JSE listed companies, and I think, Honorable Chair, the critical thing about this slide is that these companies actually control, if you like, about 90% of the economy of this country. So if we can get just these companies right, the 80-20 principle will really apply. So the department has been focusing on these companies also because their information is public. So the reliability of the information of listed companies is much more than companies that are not listed. So therefore, a lot of emphasis is placed and a lot of follow-ups is placed on these companies. Social Security, as we said, that they will be reporting this afternoon. Honorable Chair, that completes just a refresher, if you like, in terms of the issues in the annual report. Maybe I'll just pause there. Whilst she's loading the interventions in terms of since then, since September when I came in, what is it that the department has been doing to address some of the issues? So some of this, most of this report will not only cover from 1st of September, but some of the initiatives that seek to address the issues that were raised earlier. Maybe I must just pause there for a second and just check if it's okay with the chair to proceed.
Members, are you happy to proceed? the DG proceed, or you want to discuss this issue? I think you should continue, DG. We'll discuss everything when you're done.
Okay. What we aim to do here, Honorable Chair, is to do the three things. Just give a high-level view of the strategic and operational issues. What are the challenges that we face as a department, and what do we plan to do in the first 100 days and also towards the end of the financial year. And what we've done is to break up the technical areas of the department, labor policy and labor market policy, corporate services, service delivery. I must point out, Honorable Chair, that around service delivery, for instance, one of the things that we're doing there now, we're restructuring the organization so that we can deliver efficiently. What we've done now, we've also introduced a new portfolio called COO. This COO person is going to run the operations. And then service delivery will convert into something we call IES, Inspection and Enforcement Services. So what we want to do, we want to professionalize the inspection of the of all facets of the Act. So in order to give that focus, we have decided to make that a product line of the Department, Inspection and Enforcement Services. So the person heading that up will do nothing else but ensure that the Inspection and Enforcement Services are world-class, they're professionalized, and so on. And then we've got the two funds, and then we're going to talk about, or rather, some challenges on that particular fund, and then we're going to talk about some of the other issues that affect the organization. On the labor market policy, I think our view is that as a department, this is an area that we need to reclaim. We think that as a department, the leadership role we should be playing in this area can be improved. So we will be working very hard to reclaim our space in terms of labor market issues. We have a whole range of research in the department that we'll be leveraging to ensure that we take leadership on this role. For now, we have to concede that the department, we've been somewhat of a follower in this space, but we have a lot of data that should position us as leaders in this space. There's a lot of support that we get from the ILO. All of that put together should really give us enough ammunition to lead this this space. So we'll be working very hard to lead this space. What are the challenges? The IT system, I think most people would know that our IT system has been less than efficient. This system has really undermined delivery of the department over the period that that PPP contract started. The high vacancy rate, and we'll be pointing that out, that sometimes we think that, in fact, not we think, we know now that what has been exacerbating the vacancy rate is actually definition of terms, where sometimes what people would do is that a person would say, I want to have, let's say, 50 people, for argument's sake. And then without finishing the process of having those 50 positions motivated and funded, and then the person would classify those 50 positions as vacant. So we have clarified the language now that when we say a post is vacant, it must first be an approved and a funded post, and then it can be a post that is vacant. But if you decided that you want 10 people, you can't then say I've got 10 vacancies. So we've gone through a process to cleanse the data so that when we say we've got vacancies, we have real vacancies, not a wish list. So we'll take the honorable members through a spreadsheet that just shows exactly where we are in terms of the vacancies. Client services and service delivery. We've spoken to what we're going to do now in terms of rearranging our service delivery mechanism. Organizational structure was misaligned. So again, with this rearrangement of service delivery, we've attempted to align the structure, but at the same time, what we have done is we've got ILO involved at their own cost, and what ILO is doing is helping us to ensure that whatever structure we come up with is an internationally known and benchmarked structure, so that we're not out of kilter with the rest of the world. So what we aim to do there is that by end of this financial year, would be cleaned up, would be clean with that. ILO is starting around end of October, and they're going to make sure that our organogram, our service delivery, everything is world-class. So from the next financial year, we want to be operating with a sleek structure. Okay, and then we'll talk about the backlogs in the compensation fund. We'll talk about what we're doing on the audit queries. Again, it's a presentation on its own in terms of the audit queries, but we'll just say at a high level what we've done to date. General inefficiencies in the system. We'll talk about what we're doing to deal with those travel and telephone costs. They might appear trivial when you look at them, but they actually can come to sometimes sizable numbers if you're not watching. So, Honorable Chair, when you look at the CIO's office, this is the office that is meant to manage the triple P. What we've done now to ensure that we can get to the next level, we are appointing a new CIO. The ad has gone out. We are in the shortlisting process. We aim to have appointed a CIO by the end of the year. And again, there are people around the CIO office that must be there, and all those posted to support that office. Right now, all those people that were listening there are not there. It was just the one CIO who has since retired. It's an open secret that the management of the Siemens contract has not been what it should be. So what we have done now is that we put short-term interventions to make sure that we get this thing back to on track. Now, what happens every month when Siemens comes to have their thing paid, we don't just pay. We ensure that all the people around this table here, they sit with the Siemens people and ensure that whatever Siemens say they have done, they must sign off on that. So we are checking every line item to ensure that what we pay for is what has been delivered. We also are going to start doing what we should have done in years that have gone by, in terms of looking at if there are things that Siemens should have done and they haven't done, and penalties that we should have enforced. We're going to be beginning to do that now. So I think there's a lot of opportunity lost in the past where we could have penalized Siemens for non-delivery. So those are the things that are putting into place now to ensure that wherever there should have been delivery, there's sanctions if there isn't. This just indicates some of the challenges that we have around Siemens, that of the applications that should have been delivered, only those four, the CIA and SASIGA and ESA and Employment Equity, have been delivered. But even those systems, they are still going through teething problems. It's not smooth sailing, even on those systems. Now, this contract has run the best part of 10 years. I think we left with just over 2 years of this contract. And yet, when you look at the outstanding applications there, SAP, FMS, LMIS, and so on, all of those that are listed there in number two are the outstanding applications. So one of the arrangements that we have now with Siemens is to say to them, that they need to give us a program of action of how we are going to catch up with that backlog. And in fact, we said to them that that is actually the condition of continuing this contract. So Siemens has given us the assurance that if they have to get people from Germany or wherever to come back on stream, they will do that. And we also made it clear to them that we were not going to do that at any extra cost as a department, but we had paid lots of money to deliver all those systems. So we are going to hold them to ensuring that all those systems are delivered. So it's work in progress in terms of getting that Siemens. That's actually at the core. If we can get this right, Honorable Chair, there will be no queues in the labor centers. The challenges in the labor centers is those systems issues. People go there, the system is slow, you press a button, you have to wait, and all that. And the queues just keep going on. So what this is really the key. One of the biggest challenges in this department is this system. So once we can get that system working, a lot of things will really flow. Don't push me. Just go back. Well, you know. Okay. One application pending due to the final decision for National Treasury application, NSF feasibility study and evaluation is completed. Okay. Right. So this just shows the timeline in terms of when the agreement is expiring. So that's the amount of time that we have to make sure that everything that was not delivered in the past 7 years, in this last 2.5-3 years, we must have those systems delivered. But with the additional capacity that Siemens is going to bring on board, I'm confident that we should be able to get back on track. The high vacancy rate, I've spoken to some of the issues that artificially inflated the vacancy rate, protracted recruitment and selection process. One of the challenges there that we need to acknowledge is the vetting of people. It's not always happening quick enough, but NIA is working very hard on their side as well. But I must just mention it's one of the factors. If one had to compare this with the private sector, it takes a couple of days to do all of these things. But it looks like there's a bottleneck somewhere in the system where the vetting of people is a problem. So you think you've appointed people, but you have to wait for the results, and that takes time. So I think that's one of the challenges that prolong the appointment process. We have abolished all unfunded posts because those are all artificial posts. And also, if a post was not filled for a long time, we took the view that we perhaps didn't even need it. So we've been cleaning up the data, but there's one slide that's going to talk to that. I think we've done very well. We've reduced the vacancy rate to something like 11% of the seat now. We're sitting with something like 11% vacancy rate. So I think it's quite an achievement just by doing a cleanup of data so that we don't have a fictitious situation. So a true situation is 11%. And I think by January next year, there will be a dramatic improvement even on that 11. Most of that 11 is also hanging up with the near processes. Okay. And then client services and service delivery. We continuously improve the standards there on the delivery, try to make sure that things are standardized. When you go to the one labor center, it must be like a franchise environment. You must go to one, you must be able to look like the other. Constitute a performance monitoring team comprising of reps from service delivery and all of those areas mentioned there. PEMS, the provincial executive managers, ensure that every labor center has a clients complaints management register that's supervised, responses to complaints are handled in line with the standards, and so on. So there's a lot that we're doing there just to improve services. We're also ensuring that the connectivity to the ESA, again, is the IT thing, but we're trying other means to ensure that we enhance that system, because it's causing a lot of backlogs. Okay, and to improve access to service, the compensation fund, compensation commissioner and the DDG and service delivery people, they're all working very hard to make sure that we get those claims entered and all of that. The DDG SD to champion the DG hotline in the provinces. What we're doing, Honorable Chair, almost similar to what the President is doing for our labor centers. We are putting a hotline in the labor centers so that if people have got issues, they can go straight to head office and report those issues. And we've indicated to people that those complaints, the number of complaints, will impact on the performance assessment of all involved. So if a particular province will get too many phone calls, it will be an indication of performance of those people. So we want to make sure that we put fire under the people's feet so that you can improve service delivery. We coordinate workshops for supervisors. We've got monthly blitz inspections. What we're going to be doing, Honorable Chair, I think you'll be seeing in the media, we'll be doing blitz operations much more robustly now. We'll be going to the vulnerable workers in the farms, and when we do, we're going to go in big numbers, get inspectors all there at the same time. There will be all kinds of sanctions that are instant if we find that things are not happening correctly. We'll be looking at sectoral determinations. I think tomorrow, in fact, we are going through even the malls. We have discovered that the workers in these malls are being exploited. So we'll be going through blitz operations in the malls to check sectoral determination that is happening there. So there's a lot that we're going to be doing now to make sure that the laws of this country are complied with. So we've got a whole strategy to go sector by sector around this. Spoken to the organizational structure, I've spoken to the ILO. Again, just in a nutshell, what we're doing now is that of all the, what we're doing at a high level, Honorable Chair, is that at head office level, we're going to have product lines like employment services, inspection and enforcement services, labor market policy, and we're going to have the services that are issued by the services that are provided by the two funds. So that's what we're going to have largely at head office. But the operationalization of that is going to happen at provinces. So we're going to have, under the leadership of the provincial executive managers, the execution of those product lines. But the actual machinery to make that happen will be under the leadership of the COO. So that the COO can make sure that everything that has got to do with operational efficiencies happens. So that's how we're going to reorganize everything, and we think that that structure will deliver efficiently. Audit matters, I think the key issue here around audit matters has been the issue of assets in terms of the department. Honorable Chair, it's actually quite a simple thing that we need to fix here. It's a situation where you find that in the buildings where we work, we have an asset register at the back of the door that says there are so many chairs here, there are so many computers, and so on. But sometimes you find that just simple carelessness of somebody taking a chair for a different meeting, maybe a certain meeting in the next room, needed 10 more chairs, then people bring 10 more chairs there, but they don't bother to take them back. So when the auditor comes and he checks the amount of chairs in this room and he finds that there are 8 chairs instead of 10 chairs, so that becomes an audit issue, that where are the 2 chairs? kind of thing. So that's one of those, some of the issues that have been coming up. And also the issue of barcodes. You find that the furniture is actually there, but if there is no barcode on that piece of furniture, that furniture is not recognizable, is not accounted for. So those are some of the issues that have been coming up. And also you find the issue of around the evaluation of the assets, that they haven't been properly evaluated, those assets. You know, it's all those things. So what we're doing now in terms of that in particular, we've also improved capacity. All the provinces will now have an asset manager that is going to ensure that this thing is well run on a continuous basis, because the whole issue of asset management is actually a professional function which involves the acquisition of assets, the disposition of assets. There has to be policies that manage all of these things. So we are putting all of that into place to ensure that we don't have an audit matter like this. And what we've done also around these things, we've got a detailed action plan around these audit matters. This detailed action plan was submitted. It's been approved, first of all, by the audit committee, and it's been submitted to the Attorney General. Yeah, and every month we meet to do follow-ups to make sure that our house is in order in terms of all the matters raised by the AG. Performance management, I've spoken to that in terms of now the DDGs are much more involved in ensuring that the PPP, the IT issues are looked at much more closely. In the past, this was maybe the one person signing that off, but now we want accountability from all the heads of departments to make sure that whatever is written in the paper has even been delivered. Somebody who would have been the recipient of that service must sign off. We also spoke about the DG's hotline, and we also are quite serious about this, Honorable Chair, because we are going to put in all of these complaints as a performance management issue, and there will be disciplinary action if we continuously get complaints that are recurring and no swift action to correct on service delivery. Inefficiencies in the system, response to treasury call for belt tightening. We spoke to that a bit. Status of the building in Laboria. I must point out, Chair, that that building, although now I'm happy to report that the work is started to get it going, but that building was a real disaster, I must say. It was leaking all over. Building was dirty. Still some other areas that need a lot of revamp. I just don't understand how people can be motivated working in a place like that. When you go to provinces, it's sometimes even worse. So really, if we can also get the help of this house here to get Public Works to just crank up their game in terms of this, because our hands are tied, we keep asking them to do stuff and so on, but somehow I don't know what are the challenges on their side, but I think we can do with a lot more help from their side. But I must say, at least on the building at the in Pretoria, Public Works is there now. They're working very hard, and we are grateful for that. But at provincial level, there are serious challenges there, and one of the issues is that on the amount allocated for in terms of capital expenditure, not much has been used, simply because we depend on Public Works to do the work. So we look like we're inefficient, and in fact it's simply because we can't go privately and get the job done. So those are some of the challenges that that we face. But some of the interventions that we're doing, we are now monitoring traveling very strictly. The DDGs are signing off all the travel of staff. We've discovered that there's a lot of travel that could be actually avoided. So we look at the motivation of why you need a meeting, why you need to summon 20 people to come to a particular place, and all of those kinds of things. So we're looking at reducing traveling costs significantly in the next period. Also, the telephones, it's also another huge bill. We're looking at reducing all of those things just to make sure that there's a lot more efficiencies. I think that ends the Honorable Chair.
Thank you, DG. Are there any contributions from the members of the department before I ask members? None. Members, can we ask clarities, questions, and contributions on this the report by the DG? Mr. Lowe?
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to get some clarity from the DG. Thank you for your presentation. I think it's self-explanatory. However, there's one or two things that I need more information on. Number one, the Siemens contract. I fail to understand why we get stuck in a contract for 10 years and more. And yes, because of the inefficiency of this particular contract in your department, that you people are carrying on forever and not, you know, just cutting it short and to the point. Because we have heard previously as well that because of the Siemens contract that the Department of Labor is bogged down to, it creates a lot of challenges. My question is, why is it that we seem to carry on with this contract, and yet I'm mindful of the fact that you did mention, DG, that you people are monitoring this on a monthly basis. Before you make payment, you actually sit around the table, and then you compare notes before you make payments. I think that is something in the right direction. However, I am still not clear as to why for so long, and yet little has been done. That's the first one. The NIA issue. NIA is not in another continent. Neither is NIA is in South Africa. I think what I want to find out from you in terms of the vetting, because what I've seen when vacancies are being advertised in the newspapers, I've been following that for the past time now, the City Press and many of these papers, vacancies are forever being advertised. And you mentioned there, because of the NIA vetting process, that created a challenge. We have heard that before. Earlier on, before your appointment, people said that to us as well. But it seems to me this thing is just carrying on forever. At what stage are you people going to sit down with the people of NIA and say, listen, I think because of this, it's creating a problem to us. We all know that. But where can we draw the line? We want to speed up the process. That's the second one. The third one, you mentioned about the hotline. It all sounds very nice to hear about a hotline. But are we going to have a hotline for the sake of having a hotline? Or are we going to have a hotline for the sake of really looking at service delivery issues and also on things that will actually try to streamline the service delivery? And for those people who are not going to comply to the requirements, those who are not going to meet the standards as laid out by yourself, you mentioned that you're going to go through the disciplinary process. Are you going to fire them? Disciplining them is one thing. But are you going to make sure that these people, at the end of the day, they are being kept accountable? Because disciplinary process can be a disciplinary process for another, you know, whatever period. You also mentioned that...
Honorable, are all these clarities?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I think that's it, so. Sorry?
I don't know, I heard you, but some of the clarities that you are making, the clarities, because we said clarities and questions,
yes.
And I thought that when you are clarifying something,
yes.
It's something that you did not hear properly, whether you're saying this or that, because what you are doing now is questions that can be dealt with when you are asking questions.
Is this not part of asking questions? Or did I miss something, Chairperson?
No. When you lift up your hands, you were clarifying. You didn't say you want clarities and questions. But what I'm listening to is both clarity. It's questions. It's more questions than clarity.
Unless if you want me to help first, and then allow for people to ask clarity.
Are you on questions?
I'm on questions. Yes.
That's what I want to know. Can we speak with clarities first? Things that you did not hear properly, remember, things that you want to be sure that the DG is what the DG has said. And then we'll come to questions. Do you have clarities? It's clear that you have... Ma Alina?
Chair, I should think the problem of trying to define what is a question and clarity is very thin.
Okay.
Unless you allow us to ask clarities in the form of questions, that you don't come back again, because it just will presuppose that if we have questions and later you have clarified and you want to question again, my appeal will be that how about we deal with questions and clarity simultaneously, so that when he answers, he can couch and clarify and answer whatever question is there. Because I don't think there will be a question without clarity, without a question to it. Thank you, Chair, if agreeable.
I will have to comply with what the members want. Questions and clarities.
Thank you for that explanation. The other thing that I wanted to understand, Chairperson, from the DG, in terms of employment equity, the DG mentioned to us that these figures will be available of all the provinces, or the different provinces, in terms of employment equity. Now, I just wanted to find out from the DG, looking at employment equity, can you perhaps just give us a rundown as to, looking at the Northern Cape, in terms of equity, what are your demographics? Can you give me clarity on that one? And the last question, you mentioned about projects identified and listed. What are these projects? What do they entail? Thank you.
Yes, hello. More questions, members? Honorable Ollis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and welcome back. Can I just clarify from the DG, is it Mr. Manji or Manyi? How do I?
Manyi, yes.
Thank you very much. Okay, I have six questions. The first one is labor inspectors and vacancies. Can you just tell me how many labor inspectors we have in the country? Is it 500 or 1,000 or whatever? And how many vacancies of specifically labor inspectors? And Madam Chair, I'm quite happy if Mr. Manu wants to refer some of these questions to his staff because he's new. I understand that he might not have all of the ones at his fingertips. The target for pass rates for learnerships was 40%, and we achieved 41%. On the one hand, that's great. The department has exceeded the target. On the other hand, 40% is quite low. And I'm wondering why it's so low. Why did we set such a low target? Should it not be much higher? Because it costs money to train somebody. And if our target is to only get 40% of the learners to qualify, if 60% of them are not finishing the course, it's very low. The Siemens contract, over these 10 years, do we know how much money has been spent? And a sort of a second question on that is, with the Siemens contract, are we sure that ultimately it is going to work? You know, we've had IT contracts. I was in the city council in Johannesburg before, and sometimes it gets to a point where eventually you've got to throw the system away because spending more money on it is throwing money in a black hole. Are we sure that the system of Siemens can be fixed, that we're not needing to replace it? I just want clarity about that. Then on page 205 of the full Department of Labor report, it says that the National Skills Fund recorded an underspending of 51% in the current financial period. That's in the audit report. That's just more than half of the money wasn't spent. That's quite serious, and I want to know why we have not been spending the money that's allocated for training, because it's to help people get skills so they can get jobs. You made a statement in your presentation today, the fifth one, that training has been suspended in provinces due to faulty procurement procedures. Does that mean that in that particular province there's no training because there's a problem with procedures and procurement procedures? That is another very, very serious problem. And if that is so, how are we going to fix that quickly? Because then training has been abandoned. And then the last question, Madam Chair, is how many departments in Labor have got qualified audits? You know, Labor covers lots of different divisions, departments, and funds, and so on. How many of them have qualified audits? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Honorable Ollis, another member. Honorable Kumar. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have only two questions. The first one that I want to check is that on the registered workers, work seekers that have been put in employment opportunities, are they well known in the areas where there is Department of Labor offices, especially on the rural areas where visiting of offices are very scarce? Are these registered well known in those offices? The second question is that is on the issue of trained unemployment that has been put that is in place on permanent on the job. I just want to check if those trained and put on jobs, are those jobs that have been put on, are they permanent or what? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Kumalo. Honorable Chairperson.
Thanks, Chair. Look, I think the director said today the report will be taken as read, but not as clarified and understood. I should think if you don't understand, you are not clarified, it cannot be taken that is taken and been understood. I should think that is a big problem we can create if we can accept that. I should think you have alluded to the fact that there are queries. You didn't tell us what are those queries, you know. It's difficult to read a report to say these are the queries, but they are not outlined properly. We're not sure whether later you'll give us all the queries which you made. Like, there are people who have been laid off. There are queries on the layoff. What does that mean? What queries do you have as a department, as per the framework which has been undertaken on the global problem and global crisis recession, which has been reached? I should think that the many inspectors, I'm not sure your report where it came from, but I'm not sure whether your inspectorate, the inspection on the ground, is it done physically or is it done through telephone calls and all that? Because it's a problem. You say people will go to will use the hotline. There has not been a hotline before. People were personally going to the department to complain. Nothing happened. Or your inspectors will go to the ground and they check, but they don't give a report back. How you are improving on that? I should think it's going to be a bit difficult for you because you have not been there before. But I should think people before you can help on that situation. What's going to happen? Because to me, the hotline, I can phone the whole day. As long as I don't understand one thing, I can phone the whole day. How are you going to determine my performance based on how many phones have come into that province? What measures are you going to use? That how many people have phones? Then it shows that that province is not servicing the people. I should think it's a bit risky if you if you are really standing for workers. It means those workers' lives are at risk. Because I can, somebody can just phone, because if you are on the floor, they say, Bating Puzile, is that true? Then you go and represent Bating Puzile, keep on raising all those funny things in one area. And majority of our people doesn't understand the legislation and all those connotations. And they will be forced to phone to understand. Are you going to take that as a measure for poor work performance? I should think it needs to be clarified how you're going to use it as a poor work performance. It's not quite clear. Maybe it's me interpreting it wrongly. But if that is going to be how we're going to measure work performance, we need to reconsider and say what measures are we going to take? What calls, what type of calls? We're going to say this one shows that this department is not working in this province. We'll have to categorize what are we talking about. But I should think that one will be a very cumbersome situation. You also make mention of the sectoral determination now, that you're going to go to the shop floors and do this and do that. The sectoral determinations, maybe we need to say what problems did you pick up out of the sectoral determinations, because the nature in which sectoral determinations are written, they are cumbersome, open for many interpretations. Clause 19, sub-clause 2 will say the companies will provide uniforms. Clause 4, 5 of certain sectoral determination will say if you want fashion and style, then individuals should pay at a cost price. What does that mean? I should think that the way sectoral determinations are written, it's a big problem. I should think I wanted you to hear that, but I hear you that the companies are not implementing. But the interpretations of the sectoral determination is a problem. Casual worker is just an open casual worker according to the sectoral determination. Doesn't guarantee those people hours to work. Then one will refer you to clause 9, which will say you must stipulate the days the person is going to work and how many hours. What does that suggest? So one clause doesn't support the other clause. Every clause is a standalone clause, doesn't supersede the other. You read it, you go forever. So I should think on the sectoral determination, we need to ensure that the interpretation of sectoral determination is chronologically understood, because I should think that's where the big problem is. And if you can go to the old sectoral determination, you know I'm from a sector where I'll always refer everybody to sectoral determination of 1962, which was more explicit, telling exactly what should happen. But our sectoral determination currently, it's not. So I should think more than visiting the ground, maybe you had never revisited the sectoral determination and see the legal interpretation part of it. I'm not a legal person like Dr. Pasha, but when people represent workers on sectoral determination matters, is a problem. Let me tell you, one is saying on the transport working till late, it says the company will provide. It ends there. It will provide transport for late working. Whereas the old was saying, if you work late, the company is supposed to provide transport, pay it, and deliver you at the doorstep after 6 o'clock. But this one says, the company will provide transport. Who should pay? And most of companies now are working till very late, and those workers paying extra amount, and they are not taken home. I'm just saying that I should think we need to visit more than looking at what the companies are saying. I will tell you, companies are saying, look, it's your government who has drafted this sectoral determination. So I should think on the sectoral determination, more than you going to the malls and check, we need first to interpret our sectoral determination very clearly and start understanding. A lot of disputes, I should think, if you can go to CCMA, is based on the interpretation of who should do what. Majority of companies are now abusing workers based on the interpretation of the sectoral determination. I should think we need to. I know I always fight less about it, but that has made me. On the learnership, you said you have trained, you have done what, but it's not clear on your report whether all those people have been placed. Say their learnership, their this number, that number might be a big number, but where you have placed those people, are they in the, I think I make a follow-up to the honorable member's question, are they placed in a decent job, or their casuals, or their temps, or what form of labor you place them after they have been trained? We are very concerned about it. That people have been trained at the cost of Department of Labor, and they are taken and they have been used for cheap labor and all that. What are the conditions are you putting after you have trained and developed those workers? What type of job should they do? And when they are deployed, where are they deployed? So that at least we can say this, the country is benefiting out of this. Can we say that uprightly? I think that's what we need more than to get a general picture. How does help the country out of the problem? And I think I did ask about the type of replacement. You have alluded to the fact that you are looking at the international models of how to work and how you put yourself in that situation. I knew that you are new, but I don't hear you saying anything about, along with that, we are busy looking at all the ratifications which have been done by the country to assist. I will tell you, on the hours of work, there are so many instruments from ILO which can assist the country to shape the working time and the working contract. It's not happening because there has not been ratification. I don't know whether that has been checked, but if it has not been checked, I should think to work closely with ILO to meet the international standards, we'll also have to try and check some instruments which might help us, like you are saying, maybe next time we'll be driving a world-class policies. But those are the issues I should think they are very important for us to understand. You also talk about the... I'm sorry. Asset refer to 10%. I don't understand. Asset and refer to 10% work seekers. Okay. What does that mean? I don't understand. How many did you develop seek? It's on page 10 of your presentation, slide number 20. You're talking about seekers to identify critical and scarce skills development program by 2010 and 11. I went to your page 37. It was not quite clear. After we have identified scarce skills as the department, are we also having discussions with the social partners so that we can agree and concretize that this is a scarce skills, or is that only in the department or is in the country? So that we can understand what is the, besides what the country is complaining about, where are we, what have we achieved, how far is our program going to take, and what will be the outcome of our program at the end of the period, so that we can say, now we are here, this is what we missed, this is what we have made. I don't know what that 10% is based on. I've seen the numbers, but it's not saying concretely what is that we're going to achieve after that. The employment equity on page 11. I can see that you are saying 74 have subject under a. This is a big issue. And if you were, I was looking at the report of the commissioner 2 years ago, which was saying there's no upward mobility, blacks are decreasing, and all those. We are still not clear what are the findings of the report. Because our understanding is that we want to talk to the legislation. Are we making dent as per the legislation? If you look at the 2 years ago, the report from the commissioner was terrible on the employment equity, that we are not really making any dent. Is that still happening? And what steps are we going to have? Because if we can have all beautiful laws, but you are not saying there will be compliance, and what we're going to do to enforce compliance to those 74. and what is your new thinking? Because this thing that they will pay so much, it has been there. They just pay and they don't do anything. And which are those 74 employers? You know, it will be interesting for us to understand which those companies are and where they defaulted. So that the next time when you come with the report, you can check that there is an improvement. Because 74 companies have done that, now they have changed. Because I might have the last 74 companies which have been defaulting for some time and nothing has not been done to them. And what is the evaluation mechanism to ensure that the companies are really compliant? Or are we only receiving the reports? I heard you saying now at least unions are helping. I was with Honorable Cuddles at some stage, watching exactly what employers are doing and the other committee, I don't think. So these problems are there. We know for a fact that they are on the floor. What we just want to know is that what is it, what mechanism, what strategy you're going to put in place to rectify the situation which has been there for the last 10 years and employers are not prepared to budge, and what are we going to do? I think that's all what we want. What yardstick you're going to use to ensure that employers do comply? Because our main worry is compliance, not necessarily what the department is going through. Compliance, what assistance you need from us to ensure that there's a compliance. Because we are busy creating so many legislations, this one comes with this one. But on the current one, there's no compliance from the employers. So evaluation strategy, what was done, how we monitor, how we evaluate, all those things, and how what brings us to this conclusion, I should think that is important. Because really, at the end of the day, it will be rhetoric. We have been there, we have been, and we cannot say create miracles, but what is it that you firmly want to do so that you get a... The inspectorate committee, I must say, is still a... I don't know, you're monitoring on it like I asked initially on your page 12. I don't know. The status. I don't know whether we can say the same on the ground. Maybe on your hotline you must also say what you think about the inspectors, so that at least you can have the outcome of what people are saying on the hotline, instead of we open hotline for questions and queries and all that. What is the state of the inspections in your areas and all those things, what you think, so that workers can do. And I've been for 1 month, and it was a disaster. I was with the inspectors. Inspectors said, we are only two. We come with the report. Nobody does anything. What's going to happen after you got the report from the inspectors? What actions are we going to take? Because that, if it remain a challenge, we need to say it remain a challenge, but this is how we're going to try to resolve it in the future. I'm rushing. Not because of time, because this is important that we understand clearly. I don't know whether I must go to the next page, where paper which you have presented, where you talk about the audit, the assets, the removals, and all that. It's not quite clear that when people audit, they don't just audit. Auditors don't just pass into the office like this and say, how many chairs are there, comrades? You set up you prepare your audit plan. You've got an audit plan, auditors come, you agree on what you're going to do for that period, for audit. And all your departments should ensure that their assets are as per what is behind it. That's the audit preparation. And on the audit pack, it should be very clear that we have gone through this, all this, we're right. Before we can even call the auditors to come and check, we must have you've got internal auditors here who must internal audit and check and ensure that we are following the procedures. So that one, I should think, is negligent and cross-negligent. Because if really we cannot ascertain the asset registers where you've got barcodes, where things are there, it's a problem. And I should think, I have seen what you're talking about the bouncing of the police, but is that the real I think I've already talked about the benchmarking on the international standard, that unless we rectify, we cannot benchmark ourselves. And when we're going to start doing that, and what is the process? I don't see on your plan, on your action, that what you're going to do on the rectification of all the instruments which might help you to rectify the situation. But on the barcoding committee, I don't agree with you. And I should think there we need to ensure that administratively we people do their job. Your staff, when audit come, every staff member should know that audit is coming. All your assets should be in your office, and it must be as per the list. And there must be a scanner. You can't have a barcode and you don't have a scanner. I know that the whole parliament got the same problem, but I should think this way we need to turn around the situation and properly evaluate the assets. I've seen one company saying a computer life is 5 years. It says 20%. I know the standard, the international standard set is 33% to any country. But I've seen one company saying the evaluation of computer is 20% based on 5 years. So I should think if those are the issues, it's very bad if that happens in the department where we believe legislation should be implemented, because the gap belongs to us. We need to implement it to the fullest. If that comes to that, I should think accountability also, it's what is important on that, what you raise. But I don't know how you're going to measure that, but it's what we believe it doesn't make any material sense that we can have qualification based on the assets.
How many questions are left?
Finished.
Are you done?
Okay. You talk about the traveling cost. I'm not quite sure what, how much we talk about, so that next time we can help you to say, yes, your traveling cost was very high. Maybe when we get the audit, we'll see that, your travel cost in comparison. But I've been comparing one audit now. I'm fluctuating every day. But to help us to say, this is the high cost of traveling, I should think the items you identify tell us how much you believe you are high and what you're going to cost, cut at, so that we can move with you in the near future, that the reduction of the figures were from here to here. And I should think we'll try to help you with the, what is this? The people of rentals and everything, we all have the problem. But I should think that one we'll try to also try to sharpen with them. But I should think, comrade, it's you pay or you move out. And if that is the case, what you have done to the people in the past, what they have done to try and talk to Public Works. But we'll try also from our side to assist you to talk to the Public Works. I'm sitting in that meeting, I should think. Thank you, Corinne.
Thank you, Honorable Alina. Honorable Nyakemba.
Honorable Chair, can I just propose? Honorable Chair, sorry. I know it's your chance. I was going to propose, there's been quite a raft of questions to now. Can I just request that we first deal with this, and then the others will take them in round two?
You know, let's finish round one. Round two is still coming. So this is still round one.
Thank you very much. You are welcomed. MD. Not MD. EG. You see? I think now you understand the rounds, the first round and the second round. Madam Chair, initially I had 205 questions. But I've just decided to reduce that to 5. I think the points that one is going to raise are not that much different from what my previous colleagues raised. But in a way, one would try to get a more holistic response. The first issue, Madam Chair, is around sectoral determination. I thought I know there's a different process that deals with that at the level of that. I know that. But I'm just taking it from the report that we once received when we had a strategic planning workshop where the department made mention of certain sectoral determinations that they are going to process them to NEDLAC. I think it's important if we can just get a brief of how far that process is. I think those, it was made mention of, I think one of those, the civil engineers, was one of the areas that the department would look at with a view of having sectoral determination. There were six, but I think it's important if we can get a brief on that. The second one, Madam Chair, is around when the DG made his presentation. He also made mention of the difficulties in relation to skilling of workers because of recession, which also contributed to that, in fact, which made it difficult for the department to continue vigorously around training. I think if we may, through you, Madam Chair, get a brief report in relation to the layoff training, which I know that's also competence of that, but I think the Department of Labor has played a key role in making sure that the layoff training is in place, but I think it's important if we can get a brief on that. The other point, Madam Chair, the monthly blitz inspection. And I think it's important for us to say, because this reflect from the intervention from the 1st of September this year up until March next year. I think it's quite a positive approach or program where the department will go all out. But I think it's important also to indicate how are we, as the portfolio committee, going to get whether really the program that you are presenting is really implemented. Because the reality of the situation is that inspectors, like other colleagues indicated earlier, I'm talking from experience as a worker, you phone the Department of Labor because there's something wrong that you have identified to which the company is not complying. It will take months for the inspectors to avail themselves. So hence I'm saying that this approach, this intervention of having these monthly bleeds, is a positive one because it will in a way address those. But I think, did you identify the certain sectors which you think those will be the area of focus? The last one, Chair, is I think with other labor legislations where there were reports that we received earlier that were supposed to be processed through NEDLAC, like the amendments to the Employment Equity Act, the Skills Development Act, and other sections within different labor legislation. How far are we with those? Thanks very much, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Nyakemba.
I think we have come to the end of round one of questions. But let's take a strictly 5 minute break. There is tea outside before it gets cold, and then we'll come back. We'll be helping him to answer specific questions that we need. Over to you, DJ.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, for that discussion. And clearly, the department is a unit. I have a team here. I don't work by myself. So indeed, the team members are going to close the gap. I'm going to pick up just one or two of the strategic questions and leave the rest of the questions, strategic and operational, to the rest of the team. I think maybe... And also, I must just say, also take the opportunity again to thank the members for the questions. I think the questions themselves have been thought through. They are quite deep. And also in the process, we also had a lot of good advice from members, and which we really appreciate. I think at a high level, if we start with Mr. Lowe's questions, at a high level, I think I could pick up the frustration about the Siemens to say, I mean, when is this thing ever going to end, and so on. I think at the high level, Honorable Member, the issue here is the key weakness around this thing is the drafting of this contract. The drafting of this contract has not been the best contract. I don't know whether it's because it was drafted 10 years ago, but it has left the department to be very vulnerable. One of the weaknesses in the drafting of this contract has been the lack of detail with this thing. So just to give an example, you find that when you have to be specific about a particular service that must be provided, a particular application, as soon as you do that, then there is scope for Siemens to say, well, if that's what you're saying, that is out of scope, as it were, and then they want to charge separately for that. So the contract is open for that abuse, actually. So that has been really, really the key issue around why we were doing this. And it's been structured also in such a way that if you were to do an early termination, there is a huge penalty that goes with it. And that penalty is so high that it makes it not worth stopping it, as it were. I think over the years, when people are being frustrated, the biggest turnoff was that if you were to say, okay, you throw a tantrum and you say, stop, go, it's structured such that if you do that, you will pay as if there's no downside to Siemens if you were to do that that way. So the issue of just stopping and moving on and taking another one is exactly what you would think is a logical thing to do. But when you look at the detail, you find that it actually would be a lot of fruitless expenditure if you had to just do that abruptly. So what we thought is perhaps better to do, because Siemens as an organization should have the capacity to be able to do this thing right, only if properly managed. So therefore, the key to ensuring that Siemens delivers is to, because they're a global company, I would find it very difficult that they're having the kinds of problems that they're saying they're having. So at the key issue here, I think I want to put the responsibility back on us as management to say, how do we manage Siemens properly for Siemens to deliver? Because as an institution, they have the capacity to do this, but we have not been managing them well. So that's what we're doing now, starting with these monthly interrogations, if I could call them that, by the DDGs. So we think at that level, if we can clean that up, how we manage them tightly, we should be able to get the show back on the road. In terms of NIA, what we're doing there, this has been raised, obviously, with NIA, and we are halfway through in terms of solving this problem, because what has happened now, NIA has trained the department officials to be able to do some of this vetting. So there's this decentralization of this vetting processes to the department just to ensure that the backlog is managed. So that process is moving, but it's not completed yet. So up until that process is completed, we still see the problem. But the key issue here is that something has been done by the NIA to say, okay, guys, we're not able to do all of this all by ourselves, let's decentralize, but we're not going to do this irresponsibly, just provide the required training and so on. So that is happening. And then around the hotline, whether it's just people are going to complain and then what basis are going to use and all of this. What I remember, Noah was very clear about what we want to achieve with this hotline. Firstly, perhaps this question is also linked to the inspectors and so on, but Sianda will talk to that. But at a high level, we have a complement or an establishment of some 1,000 or so inspectors, and of those, I think we have some 700 or so that are physically present, as it were. So we do have physical warm bodies on the ground that do these inspections. The issue with the hotline is more about, that's why we say it will be a performance issue if it's a recurring problem, because what happens is every delivery, like I've said in the presentation, that we're standardizing the delivery. So every service will have a quality assurance, quality measure to say a particular service should take so many days for that service to be executed in full. So all the service lines will have this particular service, let's say for argument's sake, it takes 2 weeks, should be delivered in 2 weeks. This particular service, depending on which service it is, takes. So we'll create all those unit standards, if you like, per service. Now, if a particular call comes through and a person says, I'm so-and-so, and I've applied for my maternity benefit, and by that time, it's like 3 months, I still haven't received my maternity benefit, and the service standard is 2 weeks, then we know that that which should have happened has not happened. So it's going to be very clear. It will be based on service, because each and every issue that a person would be raising would have a clear standard of what it should be. And then in terms of the employment equity figures and what do they look like for Northern Cape, for instance, what I said is that with the enhancement of the system, that's what we're now going to get. So it's not ready yet. So at this point in time, that's the enhancement that I spoke about, that we're now going to have that. We're also going to also have, we started this year as well to begin to have a clear difference between government and public sector, government and private sector, in terms of separating these numbers. Yeah, but what it looks like in the Northern Cape or any other province at this stage, that information, the system has just been enhanced to be able to do that. At this stage, we don't have that information. But it's what we're going to have in the next reporting period. And then the other colleague will answer a whole range of these questions here. I think Sianda will talk to the issue of labor inspectors. And then there was a question about what are the projects, and I didn't quite understand that question there, but I'm sure one of the members would have picked that up. 40% pass rate is too low. Sam is going to pick that up. To date, how much have we spent on the project? If the honorable member looked at page 145 in the actual report, if you add those up, you come to about R1 billion. That's what has been spent so far. But the opening bid was 1.7, but we've now paid 1 billion to date on this PPP contract. Will the systems now work? we trust that the systems will now work, but that's why we have this program of action with the with Siemens, and all kinds of service level agreement will be ready to ensure that the system works. I think, honorable members, we are the first ones that have got fire under our feet if this thing is not working. We are the ones, believe it or not, that lose sleepless nights to ensure that this works, because it directly impacts on our credibility as a department in particular. So we're very conscious about this thing. So we trust that this system will work. Sam will talk to the 51% underspending, and he'll also talk to the procurement procedures and how many qualified audits we have across the various operations. The CFO will pick that up. Are the registered workers well known? I don't know if I'm not sure how fair this question is in terms of are the registered workers well known. But perhaps this question is approved and understand it, but there was a question whether in those areas the registered workers, are they well known in those areas? I'm not sure what that question meant, but Sam will pick that up nonetheless. Permanent jobs or placements, again, Sam will pick those up. But I must say, at a high level there again, it's a mixed bag in terms of that. But Sam will talk to that. And let me just address the issue of the EE findings, and then I will leave the rest of the questions to my colleagues. Perhaps maybe the one I can also just answer quickly is the issue. Les will talk to the sectoral determination and the training layoff. I think the only issue I can raise there for now is that in terms of the training layoff, where are we? I think we've made good progress there. The CCMA has been appointed to be the institution to drive the training layoff, and I'm sure we all know that the department has made $2.4 billion available, and we've also already agreed the governance structure to manage this $2.4 billion, everything up to how you're going to manage a service provider, the whole thing, just to make sure that there's transparency, there's checks and balances and all of that. All that system is in place. And I'm happy to announce as well that CCMA is open for business. The only issue now is if companies will take the offer and approach the structures. But in terms of being open for business, we're already open for business. It's a question of companies, as I say, going and putting their proposals, because part of the governance is to also make sure that we don't open this thing for abuse. We check that the criteria is the companies meet the criteria. So the governance structure is largely to also check those kinds of things to make sure that the criteria is met. Otherwise, people might just think this is a free ride. Okay. And then the members will pick that up. Let me just conclude on my side around the employment equity findings and compliance, and also just try to respond to the evaluation mechanism and what are we really going to do and all of these things. I think, honorable members, in terms of the findings, one of the key findings that the Commission has made around employment equity is the Act itself, that the Act itself is a hindrance, in that the Act itself is too lazy in terms of bringing perpetrators to book. So part of the recommendations is to fast-track that process of bringing perpetrators to book quicker than is currently provided for in the Act. And again, honorable member, the issue of the fines, again, it's been a problem in that the fines were just too low. The highest fine, as we currently sit, is under R1 million. And the commission has come back to say, but that is not an incentive to do anything. So the proposal is to hike the fines to 10% of turnover. So that is the net leg, and I can assure members that that's the only message that corporate will understand. 10% of turnover is a serious number. If you if you have a turnover of 1 billion, that means your fine, if you continue to do these things incorrectly, your fine will be around 100 million. So if you are a CEO that had to pay that kind of number, your shareholders would most probably fire you. So we think that will begin to create a disincentive for non-compliance. Indeed, we do have a very robust evaluation mechanism, which we call a DG review system, that goes through a whole range of things very objectively to ensure that there is compliance both at the procedural and at a substantive level. So, yeah, that is a very clear mechanism of rating systems as well to say how you're complying and all that. It's a very clear, robust system that looks into that. So that's what we're trying to do to ensure that we do this. And the list of companies, the approach we take, honorable member, is also the one that says, firstly, we go to a company and when we go to a company, it would not have necessarily have done anything wrong. We do spot checks of companies, and then once we have assessed that company, we then give them recommendations of how to comply, and then we also give them a timeline to comply, and then after that timeline has lapsed, we go back, and if we find that company has not complied with the recommendations, then the name and shame kicks in. So we would be reluctant at this stage to provide the names of companies because it might just prejudice the companies, because some of them, after you've pointed out the non-compliance issues, they do indeed correct them. So if we list them here, it might by default give an impression that they're defaulting and they are being irresponsible, whereas some of them make mistakes, but we want to ensure that those that we name and shame are the ones that are really the rogues of the industry. So we want to preserve the name and shaming to those companies. And also, honorable member, as a strategy, we think that if you list them and group and block, there's safety in numbers. It just provides comfort. And the one company says, oh, well, if so-and-so is also in the list, then I'm fine. So you don't want to do that as a strategy. So our strategy is to isolate companies and mention them one by one. As we go back to a company and we find it's not complying, they must be the only ones mentioned, because we don't want them to get any comfort that they are in this together and provide a conducive environment. In terms of detail on travel costs, we note the input in terms of how detailed we should report. The issue there, honorable member, was really to try to get into a culture and the spirit of saying, let's save government money. Let's ensure that they were all responsible about our traveling. So it's really to try to inculcate a culture of being responsible, a culture that says you must only do a trip only if it's necessary. Otherwise, there's all kinds of technology that people can get into. There's video conferencing, there's telephone conferences, all of those. So we're trying to encourage. So it was firstly an issue of at a conceptual level, how do we inculcate a culture of responsibility? And then finally, from my side, the issue of assets and so on. Like I said to the members there, that is a presentation on its own to go into detail about those assets. The real presentation on its own, and we have it here. But if members want that here, we can do that. It's a serious presentation on its own. There's quite a few things that we look at. I did highlight here one or two areas just by way of example. But it is a full-blown presentation on its own. But I'll be guided by the chair if that presentation is required. I think I'm going to leave it here for now. What we'll do, I'll start on my left here and start with the CFO to pick up whatever questions due to him. And then the next person to speak in that order will be Les, pick up all the questions. And then the next person to speak will be Sianda to pick up the questions. And then Sam will pick up the balance.
Thank you, DJ. If you just talk about on this question of payment, what is this contract? What is the contract? Are you, is it a contract that says debt will do us part of? Why is it difficult to do away with? Because I also fail to understand why are we so patient with the company that is not delivering the services that we're expecting from it. We keep on paying taxpayers' money to a company that is not really performing. Now, we have to do all, do you want to do all these endeavors of having, you know, a structure that is monitoring cement to see that cement is doing the right thing? Why do we have to go through that? What is this thing? Why can't we terminate the contract? So just tell me, when is this contract ending? Is it a life, is it a marriage contract? Because the marriage at some stage ends when it's not working.
Yeah. Honorable Chair, I think, like I pointed out at earlier, the issue here is that it's a contract that should end 2013. That's when it should end, this contract. But the issue here is that I think at the drafting stages, Siemens anticipated perhaps this, and they've drafted it such that if you were to terminate, there is no real benefit for the department from a financial point of view. You terminate now, the penalties of early termination are such that when you look at the cost benefit, it's better to get them to deliver or not to pay them for. It's much better to go that route. Otherwise, you'll pay at any rate for nothing. And then when you get another company, you will pay, but you will not recoup what you would have paid. So really, and that's why what we've now done, for instance, as of end of September, the unitary fee that we should have paid of 30 million, we still have not paid it deliberately, because we're saying from now on, we don't pay until everything is done that should have been done by that time. So I think if we continue on that pace of holding the fee and making sure that whatever we pay for going forward is because of a demonstrable service delivery, it will get us back on track. I would advise against immediate termination, because it's just going to cost us. That termination is not going to save any money. It's going to cost us, and we're still going to pay additionally for whatever company that you bring on board. So I think, Honorable Chair, trust this management, that with the management system we put into place, because Siemens as an organization should be having, does have the capacity to do these things right, but they were just poorly managed. That's really the issue here. So with proper management, I am very confident that they will deliver.
Thank you, DJ. We will keep that in mind. Over to you.
Thanks. Maybe can I just maybe take a bite on the financial model of the Siemens contract that is based on a 10-year period, wherein the expectation that from day one when the Siemens came on board, they were going to put new computers in and recover their money over the 10-year period. That is why it makes it difficult for the department to backtrack, because the expectation is that Siemens has over the years put some money which they have to recover over the life of the period. And the department in turn was going to pay a unitary fee for all the services that Siemens provide. So it becomes difficult during the 10-year period, for any of the parties to backtrack, because the expectation is that they have invested some money in it. Hence the heavy penalties that the DG has referred to. The issue that I'm going to attend to is how many qualified audits there are in the department. The department, which is the main vote 15, has got two programs in it, which is the Sheltered Employment Factories and the National Skills Fund. Those programs are auditable separately. However, their financial statements are within the are in the report of the department. The UIF and the Compensation Fund, those are the public entities, and they report separate from the department. So from the department side, the department had a qualified audit on the capital assets. Sheltered Employment had a qualified audit on the valuation of inventory. They are producing furniture, so there is a lot of inventory that goes into their production. So the auditors were just not happy with the figure on the valuation of their inventory, hence the qualification. And the National Skills Fund had an unqualified audit. Thank you.
Chair, thank you very much. I just deal with the question raised by Honorable Lowe about the demographics of the Northern Cape. Now, the information according to the latest community survey, which was done in 2007, is that the population of the Northern Cape is 1058060. It's just over 1 million people. The working population, 15 to 64 of age, is 707,000. The employed people are 283,000. And those that are not economically active are 322,000. The racial composition is black 39.8%, colored 50%, Indian 200,000, 0.2%, and white 10%. That's according to the community survey of 2007. On the sectoral determinations, we would agree with Honorable Rantsilosa that we could improve on the language of the sectoral determinations, and we will take that into account as we review them. If there is some uncertainty with regard to the meaning of certain of the provisions, so we will take that on board and make sure that we write those sectoral determinations also in plain language as we had written all the labor legislation. Dealing with the same question from Honorable Nyakemba, the sectoral determinations, the civil engineering one, immediately after the conclusion of the negotiations during the strike, the sectoral determination had been processed by the Employment Conditions Commission, and it has since been promulgated with effect from the 1st of September. The one on the wholesale and retail, that one only expires on the 31st of January 2010. The process is underway now where the sector is still in negotiations, but once that is concluded, then the report will go to the Employment Conditions Commission so that there is a new sectoral determination coming to effect from 1st of February 2010. On the contract cleaning, sector, their process is also underway. The current sectoral determination expires on the 30th of November, which is next month. So by then, a new sectoral determination would be promulgated. It doesn't go to NEDLAC, however. Public hearings are conducted, investigations are done, a report is then submitted to the Employment Conditions Commission. The Employment Conditions Commission then advise the minister and make recommendations to the minister on the content of the sectoral determination. And thereafter, if he agrees, it is then promulgated. So that's the status of those sectoral determinations. There was also a question raised by Honorable Alina around the
issue of ratification of conventions. Now, South Africa has ratified 23 conventions. Included in those are all the fundamental conventions of the ILO that deals with the freedom of association, the right to collective bargaining, discrimination, abolition of forced labor, the worst forms of child labor, and so on. So we have ratified those. We have ratified two conventions concerning hours of work, Convention 63. However, it was ratified almost 60 years ago. And we have ratified the Convention on Night Work concerning women. That one was ratified also just over 50 years ago. But we would be working with the ILO in looking at the priority conventions. And because the importance about ratification is that you incur international obligations. And unless your national law and practice and policies are in compliance with the articles of such conventions, you would then not meet your international obligations. So we need to take that into account when we consider ratification, that our national legislation, policies, and practices would be compliant with all the articles of such conventions. So we have ratified 23. We would be looking at others in the context of employment services as well, but we are working with the ILO consistently in looking at the conventions and then seek the relevant technical assistance from them to assist us to make sure that we are in compliance with those. So, Chairperson, I think that those cover the issues that I could respond on. Thank you.
Yeah, Honourable Chair, just a quick clarification, because on the issue of the Northern Cape, I perhaps understood the Honourable Member differently. I thought you wanted to understand the performance on employment equity for Northern Cape. This is what I was saying, the provinces, from the DG review system, we don't have that system yet, so that position stands. But what Les has just indicated, IO Statistics South Africa figures, as they stand, for Northern Cape, we have that information for all the provinces. But I thought what you wanted was performance on employment equity by that province. Was that the one? Yeah, so we still don't have that. What he has given you now is the demographic profiling, if you like, of what it looks like in the Northern Cape. But performance against that, we still don't have.
Thank you, Chairperson. The challenges within the inspectorate and what are we doing. If I may start with the numbers, the total number in terms of approved posts, it's 1,010, and the filled post is 872 across the country. So we have a vacancy of about 228, which are in the process of being filled. What we have done, we have been looking at having a professionalized inspectorate. We have developed the job profiles in terms of categorizing them into a generalist inspector, a principal, and a specialist inspector, and that is determined in terms of the requirements per each category, which talks to the requirements in terms of educational qualification, the skills and the experience required, and that process has been done. They will be subjected to the job evaluation exercise and then aligned to the structure. And we have had the DG mentioning the ILO intervention in terms of ensuring that our structures are properly aligned. And in that regard as well, you will recall that there was a cabinet decision to say let us integrate the competencies within other government departments, which is a process which couldn't be completed because we had DME going its way, introducing a bill in terms of ensuring that they have their own entity that talks to their inspectorate. And then the instruction that we got from our minister was that let us focus internally in terms of having a re-engineered and a repositioned inspectorate within the department. And in that regard, we have engaged a private consultant which is looking into that. And again, that process has to be linked to the organizational-wide intervention by the ILO. We have also upgraded inspectors because you'll recall we've reported several times here that amongst the challenges is to retain inspectors who get poached by the private sector. In order to do that, besides just looking at the structure of the inspectorate, we have also to look at the salaries and the levels at which they are remunerated to ensure that they are market-related. And we have started upgrading inspectors. We have upgraded about 750 of our inspectorate. And the remainder of that, which was the allocation we got from the MTF of 2007, will be implemented in the next financial year, which is 2009-10. Also, in terms of ensuring that we increase visibility, I think the DG mentioned the monthly blitz inspection, which is over and above the set inspections per inspector. And this helps us in terms of increasing the visibility because if you see that a number of inspectors going out to workplaces in numbers, it also assists in terms of the word of mouth in terms of compliance because you don't know who's going to be next. And in this month, we're focusing on the malls. And then next month, we'll be looking at food and beverages sector. That is over and above the plan for the year. We have also established a roving team where we tried to identify skilled and competent inspectors with the requisite, also the experience. They are currently undergoing training, which commenced last month, which is completing, I think, in February. They go 3 weeks on a training, an intensive training in all the legislation, and then 1 week back in the workstation. And this is also trying to beef up and increase our visibility across the country in terms of the inspectorate, and we'll be focusing on all those identified high-risk sectors for inspection. We also have the program called Learner Inspectors, where we're engaging the institutions of higher learning. Where we need to identify those inspectors who are studying in the areas that we need, which are, for example, in the mechanical engineering and so forth. So we're engaging with those institutions to ensure that these learner inspectors are placed within provinces where there is lack of capacity. And I think that's about all that I can say with regards to the interventions that we're putting in place. In terms of the identified sectors, we have identified for this year construction industry, agriculture and forestry, iron and steel, and food and beverage, as I've indicated. And above that, we also included the hospitality and the private security, which will form part of the monthly police inspection. Thank you.
Thank you. members of the department.
Okay. Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. Regarding Honorable Lowe's question around the pass rate, I think the 40% pass rate was put as a target after looking at the historical trends, but also after doing comparisons with what was happening in the private sector. Indela charges a learner 200 rand for the trade test. In the private sector, the charge rate is between 1,500 and 3,500. But we're also having 100% pass rate in that area. Now, that became a matter of serious concern. And I think the bottom line is that all of us would want to see a high percentage pass rate, but based on true quality. And in the process, with industry, we discovered that some of the private centers were just taking money and pushing figures. And the recognition for the Indela qualification, because of industry's involvement, even though the pass rate is still low, there is high trust and very much, I think, support to the assessment process. But to deal with this problem going forward, that is why we came to Parliament last year to request an amendment to the legislation so that we can begin to standardize what was happening within the national and the private sector, and that we streamline the assessment process, the standards that we use for assessment, etc., the Quality Council for Trades and Occupation, so that you don't have this public-private divide. And we have a standardization in terms of assessment and the training process. So the legislative amendment deals with the way going forward to deal with the historical divide between the public and private sector and the differences in percentages. If I can deal with Honorable Olive's question around the 51% under expenditure. Yes, it's true that we had serious under-expenditure, but the DG did touch on this issue around the procurement. And if you go to our annual report, page 200 and page 234, that is where we fully disclose the extent of the problem around the irregular expenditure. What happened is that the procurement process that was used all along, when the regulations around procurement were passed, that process was still not to be consistent, although it was used all along. And because of the contracts that were issued already, those were regarded as irregular. And we couldn't stop training in those areas where we had signed contracts. So in the subsequent years, the contracts that were signed already continue to be irregular. That is why they are disclosed as such, because they were signed already. However, we did not sign new contracts using that procurement process because it was going to get us into more trouble. Now, unfortunately, that resulted in training for almost the whole year, especially amongst the unemployed, coming to a standstill. And the reason for that was to fix the procurement process and to make sure that there is alignment with the regulations which we have done. And even though we have implemented that, there are still challenges, because in some areas, if you are to adhere strictly to the latter of the regulations, you can't move, especially where you don't have sufficient service providers. You then have to ask for exemptions or permission to deviate from the normal procurement, and in some areas that is where we have been having challenges. But there are ongoing discussions with Treasury, because they now understand the implications of the applicability of those regulations, especially when you are dealing with training, which is service and not necessarily procurement of services, etc. The next question relates to
Honorable Khumalo's question on the details with regard to the number of work seekers. Now, the work seekers that are registered in the various provinces, including through our unemployment insurance fund, those who have details and we have the information with regard to their names. The challenge is, however, in those placement areas where we refer people for placement. We discussed this matter extensively around a tracking system so that we can check and document the people that have been referred to various jobs, and we can then have a track record of as to whether they are in various jobs and so on. And there is a process to look at the tracking system so that we can keep track around it. There was a follow-up question from Honorable Khumalo on the number of learners placed, and I want to link that with Honorable Alina Ransalos' question around the learnership placement, because the two are related. Now, we have commissioned a study on learnerships and apprenticeships. Now, on apprenticeships, the placement rate has been between 80% to 95%, and in most cases, it is the companies that learners trained in that are taking them into employment. And 2 years ago, because of the economic growth situation and the shortage of artisans, there we have seen a significant high placement, especially amongst the apprentices that qualified as artisans. The study conducted by the HSRC, because we wanted it to be done independently, on learnerships, it indicates a 70% placement rate in a number of companies, and there is a substantial percentage on the number of people who are entering self-employment. However, when it comes to, and those people have entered permanent jobs, but when it comes to skills programs, these are 3 weeks, 3 months, and 6 months programs. Those programs have been linked to projects such as the How Train, the stadiums, and so on. So in a way, those are what we would call project-based, or the employment is short-term, because it is linked to the project. When the project ends, obviously, once the stadium is completed, it means that the jobs will end. And beyond that, it's a question of having tracking system to check where those people are in the system and so on. But the skills programs in the main have resulted in those short-term jobs that are project, are linked to the various projects. There was a question around the conditions of employment of learners in learnerships. Now, those, like all those of other workers, they are regulated under the basic conditions of employment, a special determination, which the minister passed. That is why the learner allowances, their conditions of employment, etc., are consistent with those acts. I must accept that there have been challenges in terms of the inspection and enforcement of the determination in a number of companies, but those are things that we're picking up as part of the inspectorate training and making sure that we professionalize and making sure that they are capacitated to deal with all legislation, even with the transfer to higher education. I think there is an acknowledgement on the other side that this role will have to continue to be played by the department to ensure that the inspection is conducted on work-based learning. Otherwise, we will move from the, I mean, we will now have a new problem where young people in employment are treated as either escape labor in the name of training. The other question related to CETAs and how inclusive the process of developing scarce and critical skills is. Now, this process starts at the workplace, because the workplaces are supposed to be the ones that are to tell us on the kind of future skills that we need. Now, there have been challenges and weaknesses in the system, because there we dependent largely on the strength and the capacity of the various trade unions in understanding these issues around their involvement in training committees. Where trade unions have the capacity and are familiar with the processes, we've seen very good workplace skills plans coming out. Where they are weak and they did not have the capacity, we've seen the opposite of that. But the sector, the workplace skills plans are coordinated at the CETA level to form an input into what we call a sector skills plan. And that sector skills plan is normally supplemented by research that we commission the HSRC through our labor market policy. We work with various departments such as agriculture, health, and so on, to also provide information, and the various professional bodies. And out of that, that is where or how possible it was for the department to be able to come up with the National Scarce and Critical Skills List, which is highly respected in the country. And we used it to advise Home Affairs on the quotas of people that should be brought into the country and those priority areas of focus. The last question by Honorable Nyagemba relates to the update on the training layoff, and I think the DG covered extensively that process. The CCMA has already started. I think we spend a lot of time trying to put the checks and balances to make sure that we remove the chances out of the system and we only deal with genuine cases of companies that are in distress. We have clarified the role of the CCMA, the Department of Labor, CETAS, and so on. As from the 21st of September, the CCMA has started interrogating applications from those companies that are saying they are in distress. And starting from this week, the department and CETAS will get the first batch of applications, which we promise to clear within 1 week. To allocate the necessary resources so that training can start. CETAS have already agreed and identified the kind of training that will be initiated, and hopefully on a monthly basis we will release statistics on the applications received and processed, the amount of money transferred to various companies, and the numbers of workers involved and that are benefiting from the training layoff scheme, so that we can fit into the leadership process and the president's report on the progress around this area. Thanks, Honorable Chairperson.
Mr. Capitol?
Sorry, Chair, there was just one question that we overlooked. The one was from Honorable Nyakemba around the process at NEDLAC with regard to the legislation, the amendments. There have been several meetings with the social partners, with organized labor and organized business, on the amendments to the LRA, BCA, and employment equity. That process continues next week, the 26th of October, which is Monday. We hope to bring the process to a close by the end of October in NEDLAC, whereafter the bills will then be drafted, and then it will go back again. We also have to take those bills to Cabinet, but also again to NEDLAC before we bring it to Parliament. So the process is well underway. And we hope that we can conclude it then by the end of this month. The next round of meetings start on the 26th, next Monday again. That's on all three pieces of legislation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members from the department. I've got it's clarity in the sense that you'll just give me the what is your thinking about the deadlines. I'm sure all these things that you have presented here are prepared things, are issues that you have deliberated on, so you have a vision.
you might have not given us those deadlines. I think the deadlines and I think the first issue that I want to get clarity on. When we met with the department for briefing at the beginning of the year, beginning of the term, we had a detailed or serious discussions around the inspectors of labor. I also attended a session, an assessment session of the department where these issues were tabled. And we said when we are meeting for annual reports, at least we need, we don't need the general statement that we will or we are about to do this. This 800 or 700, this number, it has been 800 or 700 of the inspectors that are on the ground. It's what we had since we met with you. And are you telling us that to date you have not been able to employ further people? I remember asking a question that says, why is it difficult for the inspectors when they go to these industries to identify a problem in advance? For instance, to say that machine will be exploding in 2 weeks' time or 2 months' time, the workers are in danger. Let's do something about it. And I remember the answer was that the inspectors that we have employed are not capacitated in that area. Now, I don't hear anything about employing qualified inspectors or well-capacitated inspectors. I don't hear anything about inspectors that have been employed since we have met with you. This number is still the number that you gave to us. And this 200 that you are telling us about is the 200 that we've been told since we met with you. I don't understand that. That is why I'm saying it's a clarity. Maybe you're going to, the DTG will say, no, it's because I've looked through this program. I'm a person who looks for deadlines. If you say this is what you're going to do, I have not been able to find any deadlines. I've looked in everything. It's just nice writing that the department is doing this, the department is doing. You don't know when and how, by whom. Maybe those details are not necessary. I don't know. But for these inspectors, it's something that it's a question. We have been lambasted on this question of inspectors by our own colleagues throughout the hearing. I know that they brought in something that had nothing to do with the public hearing. But the issue is we have a problem in terms of the capacity and the performance of the inspectors of labor. Maybe the DTG will say something, or the DG might have been briefed about the specifics as to what is that has been done since we met with the department. On the question of NIA, it's not the question that is coming for the first time. I remember my colleague saying that I have not heard what is the problem. What is the problem exactly with NIA? Just tell us the problem. Maybe this problem, Minister can deal with it once and for all. So most of these problems that are being identified are problems that we have been told since we met with the department. And to date, I don't see anything that has been done. The question of connectivity, you have, there are provinces that have no satellite offices. Because the problem is the connectivity. Exactly what is this problem of the connectivity? Who is not doing what? Or what is that the department cannot get from whom? And when is it going to be done? I need to hear the evaluation of the department. The department must evaluate. How to evaluate to us? Tell us. How do you evaluate the CTAS, the performance of the CTAS? What is that way to say the CTAS has performed or you are happy with this CTAS? Are you happy with the performance? You might not be happy. That answer is predictable. You might not be 100% happy. Are you sure that the money that is given to these sitters is doing the work that is meant for? Is it given to the right people? Is it doing what it's supposed to be doing? When we set these details, we asked those questions and we're told that there are guidelines that they are looking at. And all of them, they have exceeded the target. And when we asked who is setting these targets, because these targets seem to be very easy, all of you, you've gone beyond the target. Yet we don't see the impact on the ground. We also understand that the problem of skills, it's not something that we may overcome in 10 years or past 15 years, but at least we'll be in a position to say we have done so much. We had public hearings on labor brokers. The first day we interacted with them, you know, we were bombarded as some of the motivations why they should not be banned, they should be regulated. They have done a lot for this country. They have trained people. Not just trained people, but they have placed people to jobs. Now, when these sitters came for briefing, we realized that when the companies are coming to ask for, you know, for money, they look at the guidelines. But they were not able to say whether that employee, as long as you qualify to what is written on the paper, you can go. You get the money and you go. staying on the floor. Nobody cares, the department or seekers, as long as you qualify to the, what to the requirements. Whether you do have training or you train your own family, nobody monitors that. Now, we have a problem of scarce skills, but the government is, you know, pumping big money, but we are unable to say where we are. We know that these sitters are no longer with us, but I need to hear if the department can you say with confidence that you did not contribute in enriching labor brokers. They are talking about 20 something billion, what? Yes. Whatever. You did not contribute in enriching them through these sitters. The telephone, the target of DG, you are talking of lowering the telephone bill. Your target, perhaps the next financial year, what is your target? So that we can measure you against something. You might have not thought about it, but what is that you are looking at? Are your cell phones part of this 3.2 billion or million? Is it billion or million? Million, okay. So all the questions that I'm raising of the inspectors, vetting, which is also a problem. The 11, this 11% vacancy rate, what number is that? In terms of figures, what is 11%? So those are the clarities that I need. I was told that clarities are times are questions, so please.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Let me start with the last question, but I'm sure I'm going to also ask the team to pick up the rest of the other questions. If you look here at the actual details of the vacancy rate by number, not just by percentage only. You can go through right from the top and look, starting with the minister's office, that in the past, the minister has got an establishment of 10, and as you see now, he's got 10 people, so his office is sorted. Office of the DG, there's one more person, it's the COO that we're talking about, but that is already at interviewing stage. Corporate services, there are the numbers there. They've got a total establishment of 400. We filled 273. 54 are in the process of being filled. That column that talks to in the process of being filled is the space between interviews and also space between waiting for Nia. And I'm going to ask, is Chauke here? Yeah, Chauke is going to talk to, I did speak to this, but perhaps he has a bit more detail to say exactly what are there. I think we need to be very honest with the honorable members there. and be very detailed in terms of exactly where is the issue with this delay, so that we keep making reference to. So Chauke is going to talk to that. But there's a list there. When you look to the provinces, a lot of the inspectors would be covered in those vacancies. Those are the actual numbers there that are in the process of being filled. That means they're already in the system. We're waiting for some bureaucracy to do what it needs to do for those things to, for that to happen. But they are the numbers there as things stand. But if there's further details required, I think Sianda, we must pick that up in terms of that specific question that the Honorable Chair is raising. That last time there was a number around 800. I think Sianda must put proper context into that as to where are we now and when are we going to say now we've done everything exactly. When are we going to make this, when are we going to stop this discussion? Sianda must just be very clear on that. I just need to explain one thing, Honorable Chair, around the issue of what is it that we're doing in terms of building capacity around the inspectorate. What is the strategy and what is it that we're doing? Firstly, the whole issue of these top 100 companies, what we do there, we don't send your normal inspectors there. We send the DDGs and the chief directors there, people that are very clear about a whole range, people that are a lot more strategic, that can engage at a strategic level with the CEOs and HR directors. So they do the role of the inspector. So that's what we do to ensure that that inspection at that level has got the required capacity and competence to deal with the white-collar issues. What we are doing at other levels, when we say we're professionalizing, exactly that, Honorable Chair, what we do is our recruitment is now targeted for inspectors that will be going into the construction sector. The recruitment is now requiring people to have a civil engineering background. That's what we're doing. So that when the inspector goes out to investigate the building and so on, they must have the technical knowledge. They must understand the difference between the tensile strength and all the nitty-gritties of engineering around that. So that's what we're doing. We term that professionalizing. So that's what we do. So we look at the sectors that we want to inspect, and our recruitment is targeted. That sometimes is what is slowing down the process, because we're no longer just taking people. We're taking people that are qualified in certain areas, so that the training of the training has gotten a base of people that already have the theoretical background about the technical issue that they're supposed to be inspecting. So that's what the professionalization is talking to. And then the issue of the targets, like I said earlier, Honorable Chair, that here, first and foremost, yes, indeed, we will be setting targets to all these things, but for now, what we're working on is the culture. It's people to be sensitized, because we believe that if we can get the culture right, by culture we mean the way of doing things, if we can get people to understand that when you pick up a phone, it's costly. So that's what we're doing just for now, just to get the culture of being responsible. That has been the focus. But obviously, the chair is correct that we need to set targets in terms of this is where the bill is now and where we're going to take it down to. So we're looking at those initiatives to bring the bill down. But as we sit now, we don't have the number. But all we have is that we're really, for now, working on, just like we're talking about the flights as well. We know that there are a lot of flights that could have been avoided. There are a lot of telephone calls that could be avoided, etc. So we really want to get the culture of being responsible to be inculcated. That's really is a focus. And the number is 3.2 million. It includes all telephone calls, including cell phones and all that. Yeah, so that's and then I think I will let the rest of the members then pick up exactly the other area that I've left out, but just one area only before I hand over. In terms of the evaluation of the sitter performance, Sam is going to talk to that, but all I want to add, all I want to preface this by, is that I think it's important that we note that out of the 23 sitters that we have, 19 of them have clean audits. I think it's something commendable in terms of the governance that the sitters have enjoyed, despite the bad publicity that they've been having. But if we go to the facts and look at the details, we'll find that 19 of them have got clean audits. That's the first point. The second point, I think sometimes the discussion around the sitters is based on an understanding that is not comprehensive enough, because what tends to happen in the discussions that you even see in the newspapers when everybody is blaming the sitters. The issue here, Honorable Chair, is that the sitters are themselves not training agents. It's very easy in the newspapers when people say sitters have not trained. Sitters are not designed to train. People that are designed to train is companies. Now, when you look at the rollovers of money that does not go through, does not get paid, in fact, that is an indication of what companies are actually not doing at two levels. One, it's important that we understand that when the quality assurance people go to check companies, whether they've really skilled the people, when you find a situation where, let's say, a person was meant to be in some learnership of, let's say, being an engineer, and when the quality assurance person gets there and finds and wants proof, some kind of documentary evidence to say, what training did you go through? And when you find that all you've been doing is photo set copies and all other menial tasks, the quality assurance can't find that off. And therefore, the money that must be paid over to the company cannot be paid over because the quality of training is not what was anticipated. So I think that and media is very quiet, actually, about the role that companies are playing in frustrating the process, because much of this CETA inefficiency, as it's known, a lot of it is driven by the fact that companies are not playing the ball as much as they should. And then also, Honorable Chair, on the issue of just the whole thing at the conceptual level around the issue of critical skills for the economy and all that, the challenge that we face in this country is that also the mandate of the institutions of higher learning is an issue, because the various, all of them, they don't see, the institutions of higher learning do not see themselves as a pipeline to help the economy. They don't see themselves that way. They see themselves as institutions that must develop individuals for cognitive capabilities. They see themselves as institutions to train people to be academics, to understand the theoretical, to be global learned people and all that. There is no focus in the institutions of learning that says, what is it that the economy requires? How do we ensure that the graduates that we produce are usable for the economy? It's not their focus. So that misalignment between the role that the institutions of higher learning are playing in ensuring that we produce the right critical skills is an issue which I would ask this House to help us to bridge, because even in the last conference of the BMF, we had a professor there that made it very clear that that is their brief, to train people, but we must not see them as a pipeline kind of system for the economy. So that is the challenge that I think we need to face and try to deal with it. so that we can have the appropriate people that come from these institutions. I will leave it to the rest of the colleagues, the program, Honorable Chair, to pick up the rest of the questions. Starting with Sianda, to talk to the issue of establishment versus current complement, and then Chauke to pick up the issue of what exactly is the issue with the NIA, and then Sam must pick up the issue of, and Sanda must also pick up the connectivity issues and satellites as to where are we now in terms of that, and then Sam will pick up the issue of CETA's evaluation of performance, if I've left anything out, and also the issue of impact on the ground is not felt. I think the Honorable Chair, I think it's a very valid observation that on paper we may look good, but indeed we're not felt on the ground. So I think going forward, it's an issue that we need to deal with to say how do we work smarter, because very clearly we're not working smart. We can't be showing figures here, but on the ground we're not felt. So I think we have to concede that. We are really indeed not felt on the ground, but I think it's what we need to do going forward to deal with that. So I will leave the rest of the members then to pick up the questions that relate to the areas of technical.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thanks, JJ. In terms of the number of inspectors, the numbers that I gave in terms of the field posts and the vacancies is at end 30 September. Between now between end of September and now, there could be changes. But if we have to provide information between the first time we came and presented figures and now, that information we can provide broken down per province to show also the change probably per month in terms of filling of vacancies within inspectorate, which is very slow, I must say. It's a very slow process because as you fill vacancies, inspectors leave. So it's but information can be, we can provide that information broken down per province. In terms of well-capacitated inspectorate, I think the DG touched on that, but I also mentioned that the training that we engaged in started last month, completing in February 2010. Obviously, before we can even go to training and conduct training, we have to ensure that training is really a training that's going to capacitate inspectors and deal with the gaps within their competencies. We have to develop a training modules which talk to enforcement manuals and procedures. Hence, I said the training only started last month. But again, over and above training, we also have to ensure that when an inspector gets into a workplace to conduct inspections, he or she's got all the tools, and we have procured the toolkit for an inspector, which will include the marked tapes where you get to a workplace which is not barricaded and cordoned off, and then the inspector must have the tool to do that. Especially if you're going to issue a prohibition notice, you need to ensure that you've got the tool at hand. Also, if you have to measure the noise levels in a workplace, you must have a tool to do that. So we have procured the toolkit for the inspectors. Also, we are looking at the corporate image to ensure that they are not just mistaken for another official. They must be clear and be visible and be confident enough when they get into a workplace. We know that in other government departments, we have inspectors like the green scorpions they've got a visible, easily identifiable image, and that's what we're looking at. And this will be done by December this year. In terms of the categories, Chairperson, the job profile for the generalist inspector has been done. It's completed in terms of the educational qualification, because you don't need an inspector with just a matric, because you need them to have the skills to inspect in various areas of our legislation. So a generalist inspector job profile has been completed. The principal, and it's ready for advertisement. We just need, in fact, we have already engaged with our HR so that when we advertise in terms of the new developed job profile. In the process, it's still the principal and specialist inspector, which I said they will be subjected to the job evaluation, which should be completed by end of this month, so that we start the alignment in terms of the structure and advertisement, so that we got the right skills and competency that we need. Thank you.
Another question, please.
Madam Chair, I'm requested to to respond to the near question. It is true, Chair, that we're having serious challenges with getting results from NIA. But after some meetings with NIA, we managed to get to a situation where all these things are no longer taking that long. You remember during June and July, or to be exact, starting from May, where NIA were flooded with requests for the pre-screening of people who were coming to South Africa for the Confederation Cup. They were taking over 6 weeks to get results from NIA. But currently, as we speak, most of our results are coming back within about 3 weeks, no longer beyond 3 weeks. And maybe, Chair, this is the reason why you see our vacancy rate coming down from the high number that we're having. If we have to look at the spreadsheet that is projected there, you will see that on our extreme left, we have got the office or the program in the department, and then we look in the second column, you look at the approved post in the establishment of the department. And we reflected the field and also those that are in the process of being filled. Those that are being filled are those where we have advertised, shortlisted, and interviewed, where we are left with capturing into the system. And also, you know, the NIA reports where they are outstanding. Chairperson, if you look at our situation last week and yesterday, we could not capture appointments on PESA because of the programmatic salary increases for the public servants dating from the 1st of July. PESA was busy running this thing, so capturing was delayed for the most part of last week and yesterday, but I was assured that the process will start again today. When you look at the vacancy rate current, this is the status as of yesterday when we drew this report. And then the previous vacancy rate relates to the vacancy rate as on the 6th of September 2009. So the number of posts that are vacant is 904. And this 904 is the number that gives us the 11.43%, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson. The first question that I'll address relates to the evaluation of suitors. Now, Section 14A of the Act requires that the DG should sign service level agreements on annual basis with each sitter. Now, to do that, we normally use the National Skills Development Strategy. Now, the strategy has 5-year targets. If, for instance, I mean, the target for training of unemployed people is 125,000, depending on the income level of a specific sitter, the demand in that sector, and our discussion with the sitter result in a target that a specific sitter will have to deliver, because it is based on the calculation on the income and the unit cost for training. Now, obviously, in the negotiations, there are what we call the pull and push factors. Our intention in most cases is to try by all means to get sitters to take on as many young people as they can. And internally, the sitters are faced with a situation where companies would want the most of the funds to be redirected towards training their own internal people, including high-level staff. And this is where the problem arises and the figures. And this is one area that has been very problematic. But at the end of the day, we are able to reach an agreement. And on a quarterly basis, they will then submit reports that are checked against their targets, and annually they will then be evaluated against their proportion of the targets. Now, in some cases, the targets tend to be low. In some cases, some sitters would not achieve most of those targets, because when you do the forecasting and all that, you cannot be 100% exact, but we try by all means to be as accurate as far as possible. On whether the question as to whether the money is being used properly, or is it used for the purpose that it was supposed to be meant, I think this is a very difficult question to say yes or no, because on one hand we've got regulations that clearly indicate and stipulate what the money can be used for and what the money cannot be used for. There are treasury regulations that stipulate the processes. We rely also on the boards to be accountable, and we have used King 2, and currently we're looking at King 3 to adjust the guidelines on how the board should conduct themselves and manage the funding. Now, where we have seen boards that are accountable and the stakeholders have the necessary capacity, this tended to be the monies were used for the purposes that were meant for. And where the boards were weak and the capacity of some stakeholders, because boards are managed by 50% employers and 50% trade unions, we've seen incidences of financial mismanagement where we assisted in getting some of the CEOs arrested in the processes, because they ended up coming up with the schemes that defrauded the use of those funds. So it also depends on the kind of people we have on the board and them understanding their role. But we have also had a lot of discussions, and we rely on the Auditor General, because we are paying the Auditor General to audit the sitters against what they said they were going to do. And where there are problems, that's where we go into deeper forensic audits. And where we found instances of financial mismanagement, we have dealt with all those kind of issues. There is still a problem, Chairperson, because of the nature of the levy. The levy is a dedicated fund, which in some industries, they still view it as their funds. And however, there is compliance, but in some sectors, the level of compliance that we've seen has gone down. But like the DG said, 19 sitters are complying, and we are very satisfied with those. The question of the why are the targets maybe so low? I think this should be understood and seen into context. We are dealing with a a bigger problem here. We worked on a project with the HSRC where they showed, for instance, starting from grade zero, where you have 1 million learners starting school. By the time they finish grade 12, only 500,000, which is half of the original number, sit for exams, which means that the other 500,000 either fell off on the system by the wayside, and out of the 500,000 that sit for exams, only about 50,000 pass and end up going into institutions of higher learning. So which means that we are sitting with another 450,000. Yes, the impact, if you look at the scale and size of the problem, the size of the problem is much, much, much higher than what the institutions were meant for. Institutions of higher learning, with the kind of resources that they have, they are only dealing with 50,000. The 450,000 is dumped into the labor market. So we are dealing with a problem that, as a nation, we need a comprehensive strategy to deal with, because the one criticism for CITAS is that, given the scale and size of the problem, I mean, you're taking 950,000. You may discount it by people who may have died in the process to about 600,000 or so. But still, the scale of the problem of young people who are in the labor market is much more higher than what they could do. So the numbers that the CITAS were able to produce based on the 1%, given the scale of the problem, if you look at it from on the face value, it will be meaningless or it will be insignificant. But I think it needs to be seen in the context of the scale of the problem that we have, and whether the CITAS were best placed to deal with that kind of a national problem. There was a question on whether we contributed, CITAS contributed to the labor brokers. Now, I think here we are dealing with a mixed bag of a number of issues. There are placement and recruitment agencies who are regulated under the Skills Development Act. Those have got their sole role of recruiting people and assisting in their placement. By law, they cannot charge a person. There are conventions such as 88 of the ILO that regulate those. When we draft the Employment Act, we are going to clarify those aspects, even though the skills development deals with some of those aspects. But then you have training providers or some of these placement agencies will go and look for a CEO, place the person, and then in return charge the company a certain fee for the placement of the person. Now, those are operating above law. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, you have got training providers or some of these companies who have, you know, like Woolworths having the food services and clothing services and so on, where they've also embarked on training provision. Now, where they meet the requirements of a training provider, you'll find that they are also accredited as a bona fide training provider because they met the SAQA requirements. But I think it becomes complex when the very same companies operating other bona fide businesses that comply with other legislation start selling human beings at a certain fee, and they trade as labor brokers, and they use their experience in other areas to try and deal with this question of labor brokers. Now, again, we've looked at how the ILO conventions and how other laws are looking at the basically outlawing those practices, and how you also legislate the conduct of the public employment agencies, because that is the one area that we looked at, including the other areas of work that we're doing in terms of our laws. I think that this is where maybe the question of CITAS enriching labor brokers come in, because in here, you may find a specific company that had training provision or that was a placement agency that has done work according to the law and they didn't do anything, and yet, or they worked with CITAS because they are employment and skills development agencies that work with CITAS. And in the process, you may find that they in the process did or asked CITAS to make certain payments, and that was constituted or they were seen as an extension of the CITAS in some areas. We did get reports of specific practices that are labor brokers, and especially around the learners in learnerships, but we regulated that in the form of EFDA regulations, because this came out of an outcry where small employers in specific areas argued that they do not have the infrastructure, the time, and everything else to fill the paperwork in order to get the grants from CITAS, in order to get the grants from Treasury, because there's a 30,000 grant on training and on completion, another 30,000 tax allowance. Now, those elders play a major role just in doing the paperwork and actually placing the learners. But there is another element of the big companies that saw an opportunity to assist SMMEs that have ventured into that area. So if you take that big company that is doing all these things, you may, because of that specific practice, come to a conclusion that suggests that, yes, indeed, CITAS have enriched some of them in that area. But I think once we have we have actually come up with the amendment to legislation and the laws that deal with this public employment services, because it's a combination of a number of issues, those things will be dealt much better in that area. Did you, I think those were the questions that were directed.
Just the last one, Honorable Chair, on the connectivity. I think Sianda wants to clean that up.
Thank you, DJ. On the connectivity on the satellite mobile trucks, when we did the assessment in terms of the conditions of the trucks across the country, the report was that we need to reinforce the structure itself, that is the body, before we are able to mount the satellite connectivity. And the quotation that we got from Siemens was unaffordable. Hence, we had to look at other service providers, but with guidance from the CITAS, the State Information Technology Agency, so that we are not outside the PPP contract, because it falls within the contract. So we're looking at that, at other service providers, the alternative being a phased-in approach in terms of replacing the trucks with adequate technology.
Thank you. But I'm sure you will inform us as to when are you going to be through this. Do you have more questions? Tired.
I have one quick one.
Oh, okay. Please do.
Very quick.
Mm.
We heard from Mr. Varvey in Parliament that some of the inspectors, now it's a serious question, and I'm not trying to play a game, I want to really get to the truth of this. Mr. Varvey said to us in Parliament that a lot of the labour inspectors don't want to go to rural areas to go and investigate labour problems where it's far to travel. They complain they've either got no transport, or they don't want to go because they're demotivated, or because there's not enough labor inspectors to cover the whole country. Just your comment on that. Is this a factor? Is it a problem? Do we need to provide vehicles? Is there a real problem?
Yeah. Honorable Chair, I think it is a real problem, yes. Because what happens, I think maybe Sianda can talk to this much more competently. But indeed, firstly, if one had to look at the ratio of inspectors to companies, I mean, just to give an example, if you were to look at the base of the Employment Equity Report that talks to 10,000 companies, now, if you had to say with the, just be generous and say we have 1,000 inspectors, and you look at one inspector per company, that's a huge ratio to manage. So indeed, we don't have enough inspectors. We need to up the number of inspectorate. I think it's also a question that we'll deal with in the next budget to ensure that we have enough budget to get much more qualified and more warm bodies to perform this task. But yes, indeed, also going into the rural areas, because the department itself does not have cars and so on. So it's an issue that we're looking at to see how do we creatively work with the private sector to ensure that there's mobility for inspectors to go to the rural area. So yeah, what Vavi raised is correct, that those are real issues that that we're dealing with.
Going to say something. Okay. Now, on this labor, that's the last question on this inspector. What is that you are going to do to make the work of these inspectors being recognized or I don't want to use the word fear because at this stage, where they go, I mean, some of these employers, they don't take them serious. There are places where they can't get to. For instance, we had reports that there are certain farms where they can't go in, certain these private places where some of them are the employers simply don't want to open for them. So how are you going to give tips to the inspectors of labor? Uniform is one, I understand, they'll be identified, at least you'll know. But I think the question of vehicles, that has, it has to be there. But what else is that you must do to make them, you know, respected when they come in? When they are seen there, the employers have to shiver. Until such time we have such type of inspectors, your task will be much more easier than it is today.
The Honorable Chair Sianda will add. I think the Chair is spot on in terms of the kind of approach that the department should take to ensure that the inspectors have got credibility and they also have the dignity and respect that people that have this kind of a task that they should have. What the remedy we have right now, Honorable Chair, is the legislation. It's court orders that an inspector can issue. It's also closure of factories if they're not compliant. Inspectors have got real powers, Honorable Chair, that they can use. An inspector can find if an operation is, for instance, not complying to health and safety standards, the inspector has got the authority to shut the place down. So they've got all those kinds of powers. But I can ask Yanda to elaborate.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think the DG has said it. I think we need to also tighten and improve our legislation around enforcement. And within the professionalization, although I might not say it's not short-term, it's a medium to long term to have within the professionalized inspectorate tribunals instead of waiting for the courts because that process takes long, and in many instances if cases of non-compliance are taken to courts, they take very long, and then they don't become effective. So it's establishing of the tribunals where we can then have our own courts, if you like, to ensure that we enforce the legislation.
Well, thank you, members of the department. Honorable Nyakemba, do you want to speak, Honorable Law? Okay. Honorable Nyakemba?
You want to hear from me first before you speak? Yeah, sir. What I'm observing is that there's going to be massive work that needs to be done in relation to amendments of labor legislation. There was a fact, if you look at your Occupational Health and Safety Act, the process of dealing with complaints is totally different to a process where a worker has been dismissed. It's a long process when it comes to Occupational Health and Safety Act. I think that the department will prioritize that as one of the key issues to look at. I had Sam when he was in pains explaining the responding to the questions that the chair raised in relation to suitors vis-a-vis involvement of labor brokers claiming to be service providers when it comes to training. I just want to be certain, Sam, I don't want to misinterpret what you said. When you made reference to the Employment Services Agencies in terms of the Skills Development Act, when they do placement, the fee that they charge is not a fee that is going to be paid to them on a monthly basis. It's just to say, because you required people with a particular skill, which is difficult for me as an employer to get hold of such people with immediate effect. Can you do this for me? So then this fee, it will be a once-off fee, and then the employees that I provided, they don't belong to me. They belong to the employer that wanted those. I just wanted to be clear on that.
I'm sure we have come to the end of our meeting. I want to thank the department, in particular the new DG of the department, for the comprehensive presentation that he gave to us, and want to thank all the members of the department for the patience, for all the questions that the members are asking or have asked, and the cooperation of members as well. So I declare, with those few words, declare this meeting closed.